Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and a very warm welcome to today's broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick and I'll be with you for the next half hour. Coming up today, marking World Cancer Day. Shining the spotlight on the founder of our radio station ahead of our 80th birthday, a pope who lived in an era which, despite the signs of the times, remained one of pomp and circumstance. When papal Latinists had a tough time translating the royal we of Pope Paul VI. Well, thanks so much for joining me once again. I'd like to begin today by marking World Cancer Day, which falls on February the 4th, which has as theme this year, teach children and teenagers to avoid UV exposure by being sun smart. It's not this specific theme that I'll be taking a look at in a moment, but how Christians are supposed to face a disease like cancer, a reflection by Monsignor Peter Fleetwood.
Somewhere or other, I picked up the notion that a taboo was something to do with cultures that were very different from the Western culture, which has shaped so much of my behaviour and thinking. I was young before computers, even before television became common. So I used to read books of adventures in faraway places. And then there were weekly encyclopedias full of fascinating facts about everything imaginable. Later on, I discovered that taboo is a word Captain Cook brought back to Europe from his visit to Tonga in 1771. It referred to prohibited objects or actions. These days, it means a bit more than that. It is something about which we rarely speak, a taboo subject. One of the most taboo subjects today is the Big C, cancer. It will affect all our families, sooner or later, and many of us will have to face it personally. But people rarely talk about cancer. They hardly ever use the word, especially when talking to someone who is living with it. Even when people are talking about someone with cancer, the word itself is often not mentioned. But why is it so hard to speak about this disease? There's an excellent book called Before I Say Goodbye by a young English woman called Ruth, who had incurable cancer. It is a collection of emails and letters edited by her husband and her sister Justine. And the articles Justine asked Ruth to write for the newspaper she helps to edit in London. Ruth gave permission for the book to be put together, so it is not spying on her private life. She wanted to help other people in the position she and her friends and family were in. One very striking comment comes in the email correspondence between Ruth and her friend Jamie, a homosexual man who was coping with being HIV positive at the same time. They point out that society is good at solidarity with people with HIV and AIDS, but silent about people with cancer. Ruth's book is harrowing to read, but also reassuring. I defy anyone not to be moved by the image of a woman buying and filling boxes for mementos to leave her children, whom she will never see grow up. But there is a wisdom in her extravagance when she treats herself to luxuries to give herself a good feeling about herself, and in the way she can laugh and make fun of her disease and its excruciating and humiliating aspects. It also shows how someone who was not really religious could respect and appreciate the offers of prayers and masses from some of her friends who wanted to do whatever they could. I have watched parishioners die with cancer. I saw one of my best friends reduced to a skeleton by cancer. My mother had an excruciatingly painful death from cancer. It may happen to me. It could happen to you. So how is a Christian supposed to face a disease like cancer? Our instinct in the face of so much pain and humiliation is to scream at God, asking how a good God can allow it. Even when the anger is past, many give in to the temptation to jump from the impotence of the best doctors when it comes to cancer to the question, why bother believing in a God who lets this sort of thing happen? Faith is meant to help us be more than just creatures of instinct, to see beyond life's negatives and even beyond the positives. to the basis of all life. And Christian faith has a remarkable challenge in it, to believe that God, who is the basis of all life, is more powerful than everything negative we ever come across. We're challenged to believe that God is more powerful than the most wicked person, more powerful than any horrendous sin that can be committed, more powerful than the most negative experience we can ever have, and the worst of those is death. We may often wander into church for Mass, and on Sundays we say the words of the Creed, but how often do they sink in? Do you really believe Jesus rose from the dead? Because if you do, there is nothing to fear. Think about it. If I ever get cancer or any other horrible disease, I hope they tell me, because I want to be ready to die well, not in fear, but in faith. We need that time to prepare, not to be paralysed by the sounds of silence.
You were listening there to Monsignor Peter Fleetwood, parish priest at St. Joseph's Blundellsands in the Liverpool Archdiocese. And now a total change of pace and tone, as it's time to mark a special celebration for us here at the radio. Our 80th birthday, which falls on February the 12th. That's in a week's time. So that's why I'd like to begin by taking you back in time to savour a taste of the pontificate of this Pope who entrusted Guglielmo Marconi with the building of our radio station. I do this by opening wide a window onto the world of Pius XI, a Pope who was attentive to the innovations of science, but who lived at a time rife with pomp and circumstance. But do stay tuned for this very personal programme I put together for you, with some interviews from my own archive as well as sound from our Vatican Radio archive. That's why I begin by bringing you the voice of Pius XI. A crackly recording, of course. Pius XI blessing the crowds shortly after his election. It was 1922 and the newly elected Pope had just accomplished a momentous gesture. He'd appeared to the astonished crowds gathered in St. Peter's Square for the first time in almost 60 years. Shortly after this first reconciliatory gesture between the Vatican and Italy, Pius XI returned within Vatican walls to meet with his brother.
Yes, with his brother. He received him after having been elected, and his brother spoke to him and spoke on during a few minutes, and having no reply at all. So there was a gap in the conversation, and the Pope broke it and told him, I can't remember.
As a child, Father John Charles Roux, whose father was French ambassador to the Holy See, mixed in Vatican circles.
You are here, and you haven't yet called me Your Holiness. But he had his tongue in his cheek when he told him that.
His own brother?
His own brother. Mm. But in those times, I must say, the respect one showed to popes was very different from what it is now. One always genuflected 3 times before reaching them. One remained on one's knees before one asked. He asked you to appear to stand up and take a seat. So I suppose, in a way, he was preserving the aura of august sovereign that was the custom in those times for the popes.
Pius the 11th was pope then, Paparatti. I remember going to an audience as a child. I can't think why I was taken along.
Unlike Father Charles Roux, Princess Orietta Doria Pamphili did not mix in Vatican circles, yet she too remembered a special aura connected with the Pope, an aura that as a child she identified with what may seem like rather an unusual object, the Pope's box.
No, it was the only time I think I remember going to an audience. But we did have what my mother called the Pope's box. I think it was an old chocolate box, a large box, with the Pope's box written on it. Because people had to have long dresses and veils and black stockings and black gloves, which, of course, people didn't usually have with them. She had a box with stockings, gloves and veils, which she dished out to visiting friends who were going to audiences and needed them.
Now, While Princess Doria Pamphili's mother came to the rescue of those who had not packed suitable garments for meeting with Pius XI, not everybody came unprepared. Sir John Leslie's father never came to Rome without his very splendid uniform.
He became a chamberlain to Pope Pius XI.
What did that entail?
Well, he was supernumerary, actually. If you're called on for duty, you have to attend and wear that rather fine uniform. It's now abolished now, 17th century type of uniform, papal chamberlains, if you went on duty.
It was a black uniform?
Black with a ruff, as far as I remember. I'm afraid he never wore it. I wish he had. Could have had his picture painted in it.
So I thought it was only the lot of the Italian aristocracy to be in attendance to the Pope.
A chamberlain could be any nationality. Lord Tredegar was a knight of cape and sword, for instance, and several foreigners were.
People who belonged to the aristocracy?
Well, not necessarily, but usually. And he had done a lot for the Catholic Church in Wales. He was a convert too. Evan Morgan, the Catholic poet, became Viscount Tredegar. And so he had his portrait painted by Kathleen Mann, Lady Queensbury, in his ruff and sword and all.
Was your family always Catholic?
My father became a Catholic when he was at Cambridge, age 20. Monsignor Barnes, the Catholic chaplain, really converted him, to the intense annoyance of our very, very Protestant family. But it was all quite smooth in the end.
Anybody that belonged to a noble family, even if not Roman, could have access at the noble guard corps.
Like all noble guards, Marquis Mario Teodoli's father kept the uniform he wore at papal ceremonies in a special dressing room inside the Vatican.
The noble guards represented a higher class, guardian the name of the Pope and the Pope, and they followed the Pope.
So it was an extraordinary procession, and all those uniforms of those different charges were of different times. So it was both the structure of a Christian society and the unity of civilized Christian civilization throughout the centuries. From Renaissance or medieval costumes in the monks, for instance, medieval, Renaissance in most of the civil charges of the court, and then 19th century for the noble guards, which were a little like the guards of the gold stream guards of the queen.
So it was really an aesthetic court. That was the feeling in those days, wasn't
it? Well,
it
was very beautiful to see. I remember many canonizations, beatifications, and the ceremonies of the Vatican, which were much longer than they are now, and with a display.
As a young man, Father Charles Leroux sat through many lengthy papal ceremonies. After all, Pius XI did canonize 34 people, including Saint Therese of Lisieux, Saint John Vianney, better known as the Curé of Ars, Saint Thomas More, and Saint John Bosco.
Not only a procession of time, but a procession of all the structures of a society. You had the clerics of the different ranks, the guards, the judges, the barristers, the heads of all the services of the Vatican, which were hereditary, but it was nevertheless the hospitals. Prince Ruspoli was the hereditary head of all the hospitals of the Holy See, under the protection of the Holy See, the great master of the post, who was Prince Massimo, the great master of the horse, the bearer of the flag of Rome, of Imperial Rome, which was one of the Marquesses of Baldacchino, which was Marcus Sacchetti, the commander of the noble guards, and then the free arms, the noble guards, the Swiss guards, and the Palatine guards, which correspond to different sections of society, and then dominated by the throne on which was the Pope. He wasn't under the Baldacchino, so dressed up that you couldn't recognize one pope from another. Up to the chin it was white, the mitre or the tiara was on the forehead. You could hardly recognize a person from only the tip of his nose and his lips. And therefore it was not a person, it was the pope himself, very much the vicar of Christ. And then the way to the church, it was very sensational. Before the procession came in, there were the silver trumpets sounding a very beautiful tune. And as it advanced, there was a crescendo in the silver trumpets.
Pius XI may not have brought changes to papal pomp and circumstance, but he was definitely an innovator. He was the first pope to leave the Vatican for almost 60 years and the first pope ever to use a car. By 1930, the first Vatican number plate had appeared. For a long time, it was the only one. Every time a different car was used, it was ceremoniously attached. By 1931, he'd inaugurated the Vatican's own radio station. And by 1935, he'd had the Vatican Observatory moved out of Rome to Castel Gandolfo. The excessive electric light in town had made it impossible to see the sky. Despite these signs of the times, the era of Pius XI remained one of pomp and circumstance. Yet on one occasion, peals of laughter rang out in the papal palace.
He also had a sense of humour, because I remember you had a minister, the British, to the Holy See. Your embassy is quite a recent one, but there was a minister, you had a legation, and the minister of Great Britain to the Holy See was called Sir Horace Wingfield. And Lady Wingfield, who died only a few years ago, she lived to about 100. Their daughter married an Italian, and was a very pretty woman, but how can I say? She spoke before thinking. And when Horace Wingfield, Sir Horace, presented his letters of credentials to the Pope, she wasn't there. She was in England. So she didn't have an audience immediately after her husband, the ambassador, or the wife of the minister, comes in after the official ceremony and the ambassador introduces his wife, his family, and so on. So when she came back, she had a private audience of the Pope to make up for her absence at the official audience. And Sir Horace had recommended her, as she spoke a little through her hat, just say yes and no, yes and no, yes and no. So she had her audience. And the day after the audience, Sir Horace, in his visit to the Secretary of State, learned that the Pope had tremendously enjoyed the visit of Lady Wingfield, and that one had never seen him laughing so much. So when Sir Horace went back to the legation, he asked Lady Wingfield, "What did you tell the Pope? I told you, say, to limit yourself to yes and no." She said, "Yes, of course I limited myself to yes and no." But he was speaking in French, so I said, "Oui, Saint-Siège, non Saint-Siège, oui, Saint-Siège, non Saint-Siège." I saw he was laughing, so I changed, and I said, "Oui, Sacré-Père, non Sacré-Père," which is swearing in French.
Well, I hope you enjoyed this programme focusing on the figure of Pius XI. You can hear another in this series at this same time tomorrow. Finally, yet another change of pace and tone as we join our popular Latin lover, Carmelite Father Reginald Foster. Father Foster, as you well know, in 1967, Pope Paul VI went on a pastoral journey to Turkey, and I discovered that one of his speeches, I think, was delivered in Latin. So today I'd like to do the opposite of what we normally do, and I'll give you the text in Latin to translate into English.
It must be in the Liturgy of the Hours in the breviary. I mean the speech or this talk. I think I've seen this before.
Prefecto
convitas cum constantissima voluntate nostri coniungitur ea omnia quantum poterimus perficiendi. Ah, quae diem maturare queant, quo inter ecclesiam occidentis et ecclesiam orientis expleta communio redinte greatur. There's a double, that's the end of the sentence, more or less.
In his speech, Pope Paul VI uses the royal we.
Oh yeah, always he did, yeah. With our most persevering wish, doing all those things as much as we will be able, which may be able to hasten the day on which complete communion may be restored between the Church of the West and the Church of the East.
Why don't we skip a little bit of that paragraph now and go on to the next?
This is, of course, the apostles. Since it is, we are most convinced.
Cum.
Persuasissimum sit nobis. Non aliud nomen esse sub cielo datum hominibus, in quo porti ad nos salvos fieri, quodque iistem hominibus tribure fraternitatem pacemque possit, init nuncium propteria pronis aureus audimus, quem Ioannes discipulus ili carissimus ab Epheso ad ecclesiae.
Ad Asiae
ecclesias misit.
What does all that mean?
Since we are most convinced that no other name has been given under heaven, this is from the apostles.
What is the word heaven?
Sub cielo.
Like sky.
No other name has been given under heaven to human beings in which it is necessary that we be saved. Then he quotes Acts 4. And which name is able to grant fraternity and peace to the same human beings, since we are convinced of all this stuff. Therefore, pronis auribus, with willing ears, we hear the message, which John, that most beloved disciple, sent from Ephesus to the churches of Asia. To the churches of Asia. And this is John's first words of his gospel, of course. Quod vidimus et audimus, annunciamus vobis, ut et vos societatem habeatis nobiscum, et societas nostra sit cum patria et cum filio eius Iesu Christo. That which we have seen and we have heard, we are announcing to you, so that even you may have alliance, if you wish, societatem, or union with us.
Communion.
Okay, communion with us, okay. And that our communion may be with the Father and with his Son, Jesus Christ.
Okay, one last sentence here.
Oh, that's enough, I have to go home.
No, come on. This last sentence here. I'll read it. Quoniamque in qualibet ecclesia cuius libet, loci, hoc divini amoris efficitur mysterium. Nome exinde locutionem illam tralaticiam profectam esse putemus. Ex qua variorum locorum. Ecclesiae inter se veluti sorores is sisters, appellari consueverunt.
Oh, who wrote this? My predecessor wrote this. Hamiletus Tondini, I can tell you right now.
Why?
I can tell from his style.
I was going to ask you that once you finished.
And he got sick then. In 69, and I took his place.
You're a good Latinist?
Ooh, wonderful. He was classical, but he was not obscure or unintelligible.
How can you tell that he wrote that?
Oh, you can see it right away. People, when they read a document, they say, this is Foster, this is not Foster. But you know this after a while. It's like music. You know, Mendelssohn and Beethoven are not the same.
And this is what kind of music?
This is on the, well, Mendelssohn side. And because in any church you want, of any place you please, this mystery of divine love is carried out. Isn't it, none, can we not therefore think that that traditional phrase has come from which the churches of different places have been accustomed to be called sisters among themselves? Woo! It was glorious. Now, he was great.
What about Paul VI? What was his life?
He was great.
He was very strict about language, no?
Well, yes, and the fact is he had tremendous roots and a thought and a vision, and I adore him. And that, is that the end of the story?
No, it's not the end.
They go on to explain the decree, and he says, couldn't we say that from this thing we have this expression that all the churches are sisters? Veluti, as it were, sisters.
Paul VI, I mean, for our younger listeners, he used to use the royal we. How do you say royal
we? Well, everyone uses the royal we. We tried to change this, and it never passed.
Meaning you.
Well, I mean, people in the office tried to change this. Started saying, I. Got it? And he said, okay, if the Pope says I and not we, well, then let's write I.
So it only started with John Paul II.
Yeah. The others just didn't have, Paul VI didn't. They just didn't have the courage or the idea.
John Paul I.
Well, I don't know, for 1 month he didn't.
3 days.
Yeah, not too much. But, I said, listen, friends, I protested. I said, if this man wants to say I, well, then let's say I. And you know what they said in the office? My boss was still in charge. Well, now he's in heaven. And he said, no, the Pope can't say that. The Pope has to say we, which drove us crazy because we would have these letters and encyclicals and I, but we had to think of we and not mine, but ours. Oh, it was a terrible confusion.
And in the end, you started using I.
No. But now it's going to be back to we.
Heartfelt thanks there, as always, to our popular Latin lover, Carmelite Father Reginald Foster. And that brings me up to time. I do hope you enjoyed this broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick. Thanks so much for listening. Laudetur Jesus Christus.